Thank you for joining us for Sermons on Demand from Friendship Grace Brethren Church. We provide these videos as a way to share the pulpit messages and teachings offered at Friendship Grace Brethren Church. If you find these videos a helpful resource, please drop us a note at info@friendshipgracebrethren.com. Now open your Bibles and get ready to dig into the Word of God. Okay. Thank you, Chuck. Anybody have any questions before we get in with the questions I have for you? I guess that's a no. It was a chore today to write these questions. It was busy around here. And at one point, like Linda said earlier, I was seriously contemplating taking a nap. Harper had kidnapped me and made me look at Amazon toys for an hour and a half. And my brain was just about... You remember how we all used to look at the Sears catalog? Christmas catalog? Well, now you do that electronically and you can do it anytime. And so she came in here and jumped up on my lap and we spent an hour and a half looking at toys. And my mind was wanting to seriously... go to sleep.
How much did you buy?
Nothing. But I have probably 40 pages of the items saved. And so I went out to the living room and said I was contemplating taking a nap. And Harper said she wanted to go swimming. And I said, well, we can either go swimming or I can take a nap. And just then the guy came to start working on the pool, so we didn't go swimming, and I didn't get a nap, both. Oh, well. So I'm dragging tonight, and writing this stuff was, he was out there with a jackhammer going, while I was trying to write, and it just wasn't working very well. So, but we have a brand new ladder, and that's nice. Okay, here we go.
Reed, I didn't have a question, but I was wondering if you saw what the Catholic Church came out and said about transgenderism.
Well, I think the Pope is on a path to make legal by Vatican law same-sex marriage, women priests, and all the rest. I think he's just paving the way for that. Yeah. And if this 80-year-old priest doesn't, or Pope doesn't die soon, the Catholic Church is going to get even more liberal than it has been.
He's one of the worst liberal popes ever.
And that's saying quite a bit.
Well, when I read their article that they said they took 5 years to, says that becoming transgender, they're playing with God, and it's not allowed. They came out against it.
Yeah, he's paving the way. All these decisions and these magisterium papal bulls and so forth that are coming out. He said just 2 weeks ago that he has no problems now with same-sex unions, and before that was always anathema. He has made the practice of annulments no longer has any criteria. Used to be annulment, there were certain criteria that had to be met. You couldn't get a divorce in the Catholic Church because marriage is a sacrament. So they would do annulments, and there was certain criteria. Now there is no criteria. So you get a state divorce and a Catholic annulment, and you're good to go. And you don't lose your grace, which I thought was very nice of him. And I think before he goes, unless he dies suddenly, same-sex marriages will be legal. I think women will be able to serve not only as deacons, which they are now, but also as priests. And so then you'll have a whole flock of nuns becoming priests. And he's terrible. Not that I think any pope is good, because they all have bad theology, but he doesn't even respect the theology of previous popes. He's playing word games now that make it easy for him to say something different later. And remember, they have a doctrine that says whenever the Pope speaks in magisterium, meaning for the church, it is without error. So you have a Pope today speaking in opposition to what a Pope previous said. How does that work? Both can't be right. Both can be wrong, but both can't be right. But that's their doctrine. And he's just paving the way to make it easy for him to change and all of that to happen.
It's all about butts and bucks.
Yeah, and control. The Catholic Church has tremendous control in the world.
Yeah.
Especially in Latin America.
Yeah.
And in Italy and in Spain.
And in Austria.
Yeah.
It's just terrible.
So I don't hold any hope that the Catholic Church will be reformed for the good anytime soon. And the nutball cardinals that appointed him, or elected him, I guess is the better way to say that, they won't do any better when he dies, so.
Well, they forced Benedict to resign so they could have him.
Yeah. So, I'm glad I'm not Catholic anymore, that's for sure. Okay. Let's go. Read 1 Kings 8, 9 through 11. What is significant about the description of what is in the Ark of the Covenant? So, 1 Kings 8, 9 through 11. And David, oh, that's wrong one, sorry. What happened here? My verses didn't get changed. Somebody got a call. Let me get those verses up real quick here. I don't know what happened. Kings 8, 9. Okay. There was nothing in the ark except two tablets of stone that Moses put in there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. And when the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. So, what's significant about the description of the what's in the ark? There was nothing in the ark except two tablets of stone that Moses put in there at Horeb or Sinai.
Moses' rod that budded wasn't there.
Aaron's rod, yeah.
Or Aaron's rod.
And the manna.
And the manna. So, go ahead, Linda.
And probably the golden whatever from the Philistines, and the five golden mice and the five golden boils or whatever it was.
Hemorrhoids.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So there was nothing in there but the tablets of stone. Those are what?
Ten Commandments.
So let's, whenever you see something like that, I mean, specifically being told there was nothing but this, there's emphasis on this, the Ten Commandments. So let's look at it from that vantage. There's nothing in there but the Ten Commandments. Why is that important? And what's this situation?
This was moving the ark into the temple, yes.
Correct.
So, and also, what we didn't mention was there was God's presence.
Right, but that wouldn't be in the ark necessarily. That would be surrounding, right.
Okay.
So, what are we being told by the fact that there was nothing in there except the law.
The human elements weren't in there.
The symbols of the covenant.
Which is?
The Ten Commandments are the symbols of the covenant that he made with Moses about the land and about Israel and all of that.
Yeah, and?
The then covenant is not unconditional like Moses or like Abraham. It's the if then with Moses.
Yeah, I think the thing we need to see here is that that the law was there. The law was given at the beginning of Israel and the wandering through the wilderness. That was the law being given. It was placed in the ark. And now the ark finally, after all of the peril that the ark went through in the previous 400 plus years, it now makes it to its final resting place in the temple. And it still has the law in it. A lot of scholars debated whether the other stuff was there. But I think the grammar of this verse is pretty hard to say something else was there when it says except those tablets. But that's an aside. The law was there. The law was part of what formed Israel when God called Moses and started putting the nation together. It was through the law. And now as we transition from the tabernacle to the permanent temple, the permanent dwelling of God, the law is still there. Hebrews 9:14 says that having the golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was golden urn holding the manna and Aaron's staff and budded and the tablets of the covenant, that's what should have been there. But only the law was there. And for whatever reason, we don't have enough data to be able to articulate why that was all that was there. But the fact that the law was there tells us something. As I began reading this passage and thinking about the message we're to receive when we think about the contents of the ark, the Ten Commandments are mentioned at the beginning, and now they're mentioned again, so there is some significance to that. The law, the giving of the law, seems like it's the center stage when we have a discussion about the ark. As the temple's dedicated and the ark has moved into the Holy of Holies, the focus falls onto the contents of the ark, the law. It tells me that the law is central to Israel's beginning and to its future. It was how Israel began, as God gave Moses the law, and now as another chapter in Israel's history is beginning, the temple period, the first temple period, the law is again central to that.
Rich?
Yes.
Why would they have opened the ark, and whomever opened the ark, why did they not die?
Because that was their job to open it. You know, it had to be moved, and they had to do stuff to it all the time. So that doesn't alarm me. They probably open it to move it. I would argue that stone tablets 400 years old would be pretty brittle. And if you want to move something, remember they're moving it on poles and carrying it. So there's a lot of jostling around. I would venture to say that they open the ark all the time to move it around and then put stuff back in. We just don't have any of those details. Or they didn't open it and God's just telling us what was in it. He could do that too.
Okay. Would he use AI to figure that out?
No, it's not artificial for him. It's true intelligence.
Oh, okay. It's real.
It's total intelligence. I think Israel's unique in history, in human history, the only nation to be formed by the direct word of God. Think about it. No other nation has been formed by God's direct word. You know, God told Moses, this is what you're going to do, this is how you're going to put the nation together. That's it. That's his direct word. God calling Israel from Egypt was a fulfillment of promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The giving of the law then to Moses was directly responsible for the creation of the nation of Israel. God ordained the nation, called the nation, and then built the nation, all focused on the law he gave. He specified how the nation was to live with each other, how it was to worship, how it was to treat each other and treat foreigners. The law was every bit the nation of Israel. The fact that it was specifically mentioned as the ark was moved into the temple illustrates to me the continuity of the law in Israel. Even though during these previous 400, I think the passage said 430 years previous since the conquest, even though they were terrible at keeping the law was still central in God's vantage point to the nation of Israel, who Israel was. And so as the ark has moved into the temple, where God would now permanently reside to meet with the people, the law was the center of the stage.
I think it also goes into the fact that God is supernaturally protecting his word. You know, the rest of the stuff, yeah, it had lessons to learn from it, but he supernaturally protected the word through the course of the years, and nothing happened to that.
Right, very good, very good. Yeah, I think what we're seeing is the beginning of the transition that would ultimately come at the end of the exile, some, 400 more years later. Yeah, 500 years later, when they would come back out of exile. Come back out of exile and would be totally focused on the law. So much so that it crippled them from doing anything else. I think what we're seeing is the beginning of that transition from not caring about the law. I mean, they lost the law for a while, remember? One of the kings had to find it, the scroll laying around the temple. And so now we're seeing that transition, I believe. And I think, yeah.
The Shekinah glory, did they see that in the temple as fire and cloud every day, all day and night, until the exile, or until just before the exile, when it Ichabod?
Yeah, I think so. I think there was a mystical type presence that they could see and feel, unless he wasn't there. And of course, we know that he's omnipresent, so he was always there. But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, so literally they saw it.
I think
and so. So when he left, it was obvious that he left.
Right.
Okay.
Now imagine how chilling that would be to know that your God just left you.
I think that's scaring me to death.
Yeah.
Gives me goosebumps now.
I think this passage here in 1 Kings 8 just reminds us how God was working and was keeping his law, his word, in the forefront of everything going on. And as Linda said, preserving it. Questions, comments? Okay, let's read 1 Kings 9, 1 through 9. And let's discover some principles there from 1 Kings 9, 1 through 9. Let's see if I got them in right this time. Hey, I did. As soon as Solomon was finished building the house of the Lord in the king's house, and all that Solomon desired to build, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time as he appeared to him in Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea, which you have made before me. I've consecrated this house that you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. And as for you, if you will walk before me as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and keeping my statutes and my rules, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever. as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. But if you turn aside from following me, or if your children, you or your children, and you do not keep my commandments and my statutes that I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and the house that I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight, and Israel will become a proverb and a byword among the peoples. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone passing by it will be astonished and will hiss, and they will say, why has the Lord done this thus to the land, to his house? And, oops, went too far. Then they will say, because they have abandoned the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and laid hold of the other gods and worshiped them and served them, therefore the Lord has brought all this disaster on them. So what principles do we see in this passage?
Obedience brings reward. Disobedience brings punishment or consequence, however you want to say it.
Okay, good.
If they forsake him, he will forsake them.
Right.
When our focus is removed from God, he will remove his blessings from us.
Yeah, very good.
I don't know that it's a principle, but God's heart is still for Israel. He says it will be there forever.
Right. Even when he Ichabods.
Yeah. I'm not sure it's a verb, but I like it.
Well, you can make anything a verb. I mean, just Google it and see. Ba-dum-bum. Solomon achieved tremendous success, didn't he? From a worldly point of view. He had built fantastic complexes and buildings. What we don't understand is how big the complex was of Solomon's house. It was not just his house. It was the government operations center for Israel. It was at least five buildings in next to the temple, where the Temple Mount is today. It was five huge buildings. It was the Supreme Court, the White House, and the Congress all in one place. And all the ancillary functions of his government all happened right there. Fantastic buildings that rivaled any in the known world at the time. He had a reputation of being the wisest king ever. He became one of the richest kings ever. By worldly standards, he had tremendous success. By all accounts, Solomon was a great man. But then, as you read further, God still presents Solomon with the word that requires even this great man, Solomon, to remain faithful to the Lord. No matter how successful, here's a principle. No matter how successful we are at serving the Lord, by whatever metric of success is used, we still got to obey Him. You know, the greatest evangelists, the greatest preachers, the greatest missionaries, they still had to obey. Our worldly success does not buy us special treatment from God. We're always responsible to God to be obedient to Him. Now here's another principle on that line. Biblical truth is never abrogated by who you are or what you have done. You could be the Billy Graham and the Albert Schweitzer and every other kind of great Christian that did all sorts of fantastic things, and you would still have to be obedient. God never gave them a pass. That's good. Biblical truth is never abrogated by who or what we are. Questions or comments on that one? Okay. Read 1 Kings 11, 1 through 8. Explain what happened in this passage. 1 Kings 11, 1 through 8. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. From the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, "You shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods." Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, who were princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. And what is it that Les would say?
That ain't right.
That ain't right.
Hey, in there, one of the words just read there, just hit me. He's not to take them in marriage, nor they he.
Right. Isn't that the same thing?
I'm thinking that it just, you go into marriage together.
Right.
What was happening there, I mean,
well, the,
I understand a fixed marriage on his side, but how could she enter marriage with him?
Well,
the, well, it was property for her father, not her.
Right, that's exactly right. Yeah, the...
There were 700 countries, or provinces, or cities,
right,
that you could marry 700 princesses.
Right. Yeah, the what was happening, Chuck, was the fact that these are arranged marriages. The woman has very little to say in it. But every once in a while, the daughter of a king will say, "I really want that guy." And the king arranges it. So it does happen, but typically it happens the other way. The man decides, and the mom and dad, usually the dad of the bride, decides, and the bride has very little to say about it.
Pastor, can I ask you why you think I thought Rachel was a Christian? He wasn't.
No, I use that name as just a guy that did some fantastic medicine stuff.
But he denied the existence of Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. It was probably a poor choice of Christian doctors. Or of doctors, yeah.
Okay.
Where would he have gotten 700 princesses?
Well, you're thinking of the 190...
Easy.
You're thinking of the 192 countries we have today. There were a lot more kingdoms then, and remember, every little city state was a kingdom. You think of Greece, but you're not thinking of Macedonia and Sparta and all of those little kingdoms and so forth. There, 700 is not difficult.
Athens and Iona.
Exactly.
On and on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not wholly follow the Lord, as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Moloch, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. That would be the Mount of Olives, by the way. And so he did for all his foreign wives, and made their offerings and sacrifices to their gods. So explain what happened.
Well, kind of sounds like Solomon did what his forebears did during the conquest. They didn't pay attention to what God was telling them to do and not associate themselves with the pagans around them.
Yeah,
and they brought them down.
Exactly as God said would happen. don't take wives from these people because they will lead you astray. And so what's he do? He takes 700 of them. Now, concubines are second-class wives, let's say. They have no status, legal status, to inherit. And their children, without special edict from the king, have no legal status. They are basically sex toys for the man. They are legal sex toys. That's the definition of concubine. So he has 700 wives who are princesses that are wives of convenience for there to be peace treaties. And as we've read in the passages today, he ruled everything from the Euphrates down to Egypt. So all of the Levant was under Solomon's control, and he either ruled it or had treaties with all of the kings of the Levant through their daughters, 700 of them. And then he had his 300 girlfriends.
He was quite busy.
Yeah. Yeah.
To put it mildly.
Yeah. And just as God had told him, they're going to draw you away. And so they did. But there had to be one wife from him that was the chief wife who had the primary power and was over all the other wives and concubines. That probably was Pharaoh's daughter.
That's just to say Pharaoh's daughter.
So that was the greatest of the alliances with Pharaoh.
He built Pharaoh's daughter a separate house.
He built them all separate houses.
He built 1,000 houses?
Well, probably not the concubines. They probably had dorms. But the wives, yeah. Solomon was a tremendous builder. And there are a number... modern archaeology is discovering more and more and more Solomonic building projects in Israel. They're all over Israel. And the speculation is, I just read something on this a couple weeks ago, the speculation is that most of the wives had homes not in and around Jerusalem. They were spread out all over Israel. I think this passage, I think, is a transition passage of a God-fearing, wise Solomon and successful in everything he did to the beginning of the fall of both Israel and eventually Judah. This is where the wheels fall off the nation. David's adultery and murder and probable rape doesn't even come close to comparing to what Solomon did. Because not only did Solomon do it himself, he led the country in doing it. So David didn't lead the country in murder and adultery, and he repented of it. To our knowledge, Solomon never repented of all of this. But it again proves that God was right. I'm sorry?
I read a note here. It said he pursued not only the women, but the gods they served.
Right.
Also.
Right. Which
so
is
another stray.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what God said will happen. Don't marry these foreign women, because they're going to bring their gods with them, and you're going to fall for that.
And they did.
Yep.
Do you suppose that when he writes Ecclesiastes and these things, he says everything is vanity? That he isn't in some way commenting on the mess he made with all of this?
It could be. It depends on when you believe he wrote it.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either.
He doesn't really, he sounds sorrowful, but he doesn't sound contrite.
Right.
In Ecclesiastes. He's depressed about it, but not.
He's depressed about it, but it wasn't his fault.
Yeah. Just kind of like today.
Okay. Let's keep on going. This is, read 1 Kings 12, 25 through 33. What's the significance of the golden calves? So just to set the stage, this is now Solomon's dead, and we have the division of the 10 tribes to the north and the 2 tribes to the south. And we have a fear that there was going to be problems when the Jews from the north would go to Jerusalem to worship, because that's their system, and that was in now enemy territory. So 1 Kings 12, 25. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there, and he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David if the people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem. Then the heart of this people will turn again to their Lord, to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah." So the king took counsel and made 2 calves of gold, and he said to the people, "You have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And he set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Then this thing became a sin for the people, went as far as Dan before one. He also made temples on high places and appointed priests from among the people who were not of the Levites. And Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 5th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and he offered sacrifices on the altar, so he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he made, and placed in Bethel the priest of the places that he had made. He went up to the altar that he had made in Bethel, and on the 15th day in the 8th month, in the month that he had devised from his own heart, and he instituted a feast for the people of Israel, and went up to the altar to make offerings. So, what's the significance of the golden calves?
They were like what Aaron built at Mount Sinai, and they're like Baal and the god Sin from Egypt.
Correct. There's more.
Well, you know, the public official statement was that, you know, it's too far to go to Jerusalem, and, you know, here you can worship here, but the plan was to solidify the kingdom and keep people from realigning with Judah.
Right, right. Yeah, there was some pragmatism going on. Go ahead.
Another thing that always has baffled me, Moses forbade, God forbade it, but and yet they're doing it
again.
It didn't work then. Why did they think it would work now?
They didn't care.
It never works to not follow God, but people do it all the time.
I have a note here that you said last year that every false religion has commonalities with the Tower of Babel.
That's correct.
But I don't know why I wrote that.
Because I said it.
Yes, but it was funny. But I don't understand how or why now. Apparently the rest of that conversation left my head.
Every false religion has some sort of nexus to the false religion that was practiced at Babel. It doesn't matter what false religion there is. There is a good nexus to what happened at Babel. A lot of that is because of the poofing of the people to the various places. So there's commonality of experience, not of word anymore, but of experience. But every false religion has some sort of nexus to what happened at Babel. In other words, Babel was led by Satan. There is nothing that is in a false religion. I shouldn't say that. I'm saying it backwards. Satan led the what happened at Babel. Behind the scenes, obviously, we don't see him directing it, but behind the scenes. And he has directed every false religion to have its its place, and there is some sort of connection. I can't remember the name of the author that wrote on this rather extensively. It was originally his PhD dissertation, and then he's got a series of books that come from it that show us how every false religion has this connection to things that were done and said at Babel.
You give me just one connection so I can kind of put this together in my head?
Well, what is it that Satan said initially? I'm going to be like the Most High.
Right.
Well, that's the picture that you see in the majority of these false religions. There is a way for you to ascend to be the Most High. Mormonism, for example. What is the goal of a Mormon? Is the goal of the Mormon to save you? No. The goal of the Mormon is to become a little god himself.
Correct.
So you see the connection then to the ideology, to the theology, if you will, of Babel. Why were they building the tower? So we can be like God.
Yeah.
So we can rule ourselves. We don't need to hear God. And every false religion has that kind of connection.
Got it. Now I can add it to the notes so they make sense. Thank you.
So when Jeroboam, I get these backwards. Was it Rehoboam or Jeroboam? Anyway, when Boam.
Jeroboam.
When he introduces the calves, what's he say? Here's your God. He is making these calves a representation of God, which God specifically said don't do.
Yeah.
And he's saying he's the God that brought you out of Egypt. Now, what is that? That's idolatry. But what else is it?
It's disobedience.
Yes. It's pragmatism.
Right back to the beginning.
Go ahead, Linda.
It's taking them right back to where they were before they ever left Egypt.
Right, right. It's pragmatism. We don't know what happened to Moses up on the mountain, so we need to have something the people can focus on. So let's make a golden calf. I mean, Aaron's excuse that I threw it in the fire and it popped out, you know, that's pretty lame. Nobody, including Moses, believed that. And so here, Rehoboam is saying to the folks, look. I don't want you going to Jerusalem because then you're going to get connected with Judah again and you're going to kill me. So I don't want you doing that. So in order to save my life, let's just worship these golden calves. They're your God. He wanted to hold his power. To him, holding his power was more important than being obedient. He knew what God had said. It was just more important to hold his power. He didn't want to do what God said. And the significance of the golden calves is it was something that was recognizable to Israel. They all knew the story. And there's pretty good speculation that it is a recognizable symbol in the Levant. Maybe even broader than the Levant. Maybe Aaron made the golden calf because of its symbolism in Egypt and in the false religions of the people around Israel. So it was something that was easily recognizable when they saw it.
Well, it still isn't.
What's that, Nance?
I said, what a giant sin.
Yeah.
All those people have to.
And what an affront to God, right?
That's what, what a giant thing to do. Mercy yeah. Days.
Yep.
Yeah. I think even more than that, the audacity to call it not only your God, but to call it Yahweh.
Yeah, this is your God that brought you out of Egypt. Yeah.
Yeah, to influence them to worship that way. Oh, my. Yeah.
But also in the passage, we see that in many ways, I think the creation of the golden calf seems like a stab at the law of God, because clearly in Moses' writing, he said, you're not going to do that. Don't make any graven idols. Don't make any graven images of me.
Right.
Right, so he's stabbing Moses' law. But also, he is violating the law that said that when you'll only worship where the tabernacle is, and then when the temple was built, the law was amended to say you'll only worship in Jerusalem. You'll only have sacrifice in Jerusalem. So now he's amending the law to his own advantage, saying, no, we can do it up here because I don't want you going down there. So he subverted the law then next by appointing priests who were not Levites. Now, all of those things, where you worshiped, how you worshiped, when you worshiped. Oh, there's one additional. He appointed feasts at his own time that were not consistent with the other feasts. But all of those things, who you worship, when you worship, where you worship, and how you worship, were all prescribed by law. He did them differently. He subverted the law of God. In 2 Chronicles, we read a little additional tidbit to this. He not only made non-Levites priests, he specifically prevented the Levites from being priests. So he did everything counter to the law, almost like he was sticking his finger in the chest of God. From my vantage point, if anybody deserved DRT, it was him, right?
Yeah, I'm just going to say you don't poke at God.
Right.
That's a silly thing to do.
Yeah.
Okay, the last question I have, it'll take us too long to get through, we only have 3 minutes, but from 2 Kings 2, and that is the poofing of Elijah. And I asked the question, what from 2 Kings 2, 1 through 12, what principles do you see in that as Elijah was poofed out of there? The bottom line to the story of Elijah being poofed is one of the reasons for Baal worship was Baal was considered the Baal was considered the rider of the clouds. He was the god. Remember, they have multiple gods. He was the god that was given the ability to ride on the clouds to see coming and going in this supernatural way. So. He's taken up in a whirlwind to say, hey, you want to see somebody ride the clouds? He was not taken up in a chariot of fire. It was there. He was taken up in the whirlwind. You want to see somebody ride the whirlwind? Ride the wind? Watch this. Mm-hmm. That's what God was saying through Elijah to Israel. Just watch this. I'll show you Baal's got nothing on me.
Isn't that interesting?
Yep.
That's a new fact.
Yep. It's not a new fact. Just now known, was not previously known to you.
Well, okay. It's a new fact to me.
There you go. Sandy, be gone.
Okay.
Any other questions, comments? Hearing nothing, then Chuck, you get to pray a minute early tonight.
Father, we do. Thank you for your word, your communication to us. Lord, that we can learn from those in the past, from history, from godly figures, from figures not so godly. Lord, we pray that we can learn lessons in how to obey you, how to not circumvent your rules, your laws, your desires, as you know we've seen here tonight. Lord, bless us as we try to live our lives faithfully. In your name I pray. Amen.
Thank you for watching or listening to this teaching on demand from Friendship Grace Brethren Church.
please consider sending us an email at info@friendshipgracebrethren.com to let us know how this teaching may have helped you. Please also consider joining us in person at Friendship Grace Brethren Church, located at 10251 Metro Parkway, Suite 116, Fort Myers, Florida, just south of the intersection of Metro and Colonial Boulevard. Sunday school begins at 9 and worship service at 10 a.m. We look forward to seeing you in person at Friendship Grace Brethren Church.